I start, I'd just like to acknowledge my co-authors on this work, Andrew Leakey, Steve Long, Don Ort, and Alistair Rogers. And so I'm going to talk to you today mostly about the rise in atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration. And I suppose that in the past couple of weeks, this paper just came out in PNAS. And what it showed was that generally this graph shows the flux of CO2 into the atmosphere from both fossil fuel combustion and also from land use change. And essentially, the message from this paper was that right now, the increase in carbon dioxide is faster than we expected, and it's also generating stronger than expected climate forcing, and that's sooner than expected. So the experiments that I'm going to talk to you about today were mostly done at about 550 parts per million, which is what we, what the IPCC projected conservatively for about the middle of this century. But the more recent evidence suggests that we're probably reaching that faster than we thought. And so the main question that this research addresses is how will changes in atmospheric carbon dioxide affect the major agricultural ecosystems? And so what are we talking about? Well, we're talking about corn, and it was estimated that about 700 million metric tons were produced in the 2006-2007 growing season. Wheat, which is second at about 600 million metric tons. Rice at about 400 million metric tons, and finally soybean at about 236 million metric tons. And these are all figures from the USDA. And so what I'm going to talk to you about are free air concentration enrichment experiments. And this is a picture of one of them. This is the soy face experiment that's located in Champaign, Illinois. And what you're looking, this is an aerial photograph of the field set up there. And so each of these plots that you see here that are slightly different color are the face rings. This is our CO2 canister here, basically, where the CO2 is then vaporized and sent out to these rings. And if we zoom in on one of these rings, what you see is a plot of land, and this is a completely open air environment. And then it's surrounded by an octagon of pipes here. And these are 20 meters in diameter. And so one of the criticisms of FACE that's a typical criticism and a very fair criticism is that it's expensive. And that's true. There's a very high initial startup cost for FACE. But if you look at the scale and the size of these plots, there's quite a bit of research that can be done within a single plot. And it can facilitate research from a number of different scientists. And so I think that maybe a plant-by-plant comparison of FACE versus chambers would be an interesting study in the numbers and the cost, actually, of the FACE experiments. But anyway, what you can see here is this octagon of pipes surrounding this plot. And depending on the wind speed and the wind direction, these different pipes are open. And then the eddies of wind carry the air across the plot, maintaining a higher CO2 concentration. Or also an ozone concentration in the case of soy face. So around the world, there have been a handful of face experiments with food crops. There's the one that I mentioned in central Illinois with maize and soybean. There was one in Maricopa, Arizona that investigated wheat and sorghum. There was a large-scale face experiment in Europe with wheat, barley, sugar beets. There's a rice experiment that started in Japan and then moved across to China, and this one is still running, and now it's added wheat as well. And just last year, another FACE experiment with wheat started in Australia, in Victoria, Australia. And so what's notable here is that there aren't very many of these, but there are enough probably to do a meta-analysis. And so that's what I'm going to talk to you about today, is the meta-analysis that we've done with the FACE experiments. And so what is a meta-analysis? Well, it's basically an analysis of analyses. And so it's a way to quantitatively summarize a number of different studies. And so the effect of additional treatments or conditions, so say different species or nitrogen treatments, can be statistically compared with meta-analyses. And this allows for hypothesis testing. And Rich just mentioned how important it is to have these experiments grounded in good hypotheses. And we felt that the FACE data are particularly well-suited to meta-analysis because they have similar experimental designs and similar methods, and they also have similar target CO2 concentrations at about 550 to 600 parts per million. So the way that we carried out this analysis was to first search the relevant databases, and so we used the Web of Science and Agricola to find all of the face studies. And then from those original papers, we extracted the means, the standard deviations, and the sample sizes from each study to create databases of crop responses to elevated CO2. The natural log of the response ratio was used for all of these studies, and what that is just the response in elevated CO2 over the response in ambient CO2. And then we performed a mixed model analysis based on the assumption that there's random variation in between the studies. And we also weighted each of these responses, so we weighted each of the responses in CO2 versus ambient CO2 based on the sample size and also the standard deviation of each individual study. So it gives a measure of the accuracy and precision of each individual study. And finally, all of our analyses were done with the MeadowWind statistical software. So today I'd just like to present the results from two different hypotheses that we addressed with this work. The first was that we hypothesized that the decrease in stomatal conductance at elevated CO2 in face studies is caused by both a reduced stomatal aperture and reduced stomatal density. And then second, that the mean response of crop photosynthesis to elevated CO2 in face studies would be greater than the response of the biomass, which in turn would then be greater than the seed yield response. And so most of the graphs that I'm going to show you today have a percent change at elevated CO2, either along the X or Y axis, in this case along the X axis, and then different, in this case, categorical groups. And so what the gray bar illustrates here is the mean response of all plants that are grown under face experiments and their mean responses to model conductance to elevated CO2. And so what you can see is that on average, plants decrease the model conductance by 21% at elevated CO2, and that's give or take 3%. That's the 95% confidence interval. We can focus in here on C4 and C3 crops. So C4 crops decrease the model conductance by about 30% and C3 crops by about 25%. And so the question that we wanted to ask then was, what's the mechanism of this reduced stomatal conductance? Is it just aperture, or is it also stomatal density? And so we then reviewed the percent change in stomatal density at elevated CO2. And this just shows a frequency histogram, so it's the number of studies within each of these categories. This bullet point here shows the average response, which is a non-significant 5% decrease in stomatal density at elevated CO2. And so our conclusion there was that while a few studies reported large changes in stomatal density, so you can see here, you know, there's 3 to 5 studies with some significant changes in stomatal density, the mean response was a non-significant 5% reduction. And so therefore, we concluded that the change in stomatal aperture rather than the change in stomatal density explained most of the conductance response to elevated CO2. So I'd like to move on now to the second hypothesis, that the response of photosynthesis will be greater than the response of biomass, which in turn will be greater than the response of seed yield. And so again, what I'm showing here is the percent change in elevated CO2, and each bar represents the mean response, and then the error bars are 95% confidence intervals. And so this response shows the effects of elevated CO2 on the daily integral of photosynthetic carbon uptake. This is from light saturated leaves at the top of the canopy. And C3 crops show about a 20% increase in photosynthesis when integrated over the day. C4 crops, about a 5% increase, and that's non-significant. The effects on biomass for C3 crops are about a 17% increase at elevated CO2, whereas C4 crops show about a 6%, again, non-significant increase in above-ground biomass. And then if we look at seed yield, there's about a 13% on average increase in C3 crop seed yield at elevated CO2 in face studies. And there's a non-significant 1% decrease, so there's basically no change in C4 yield at elevated CO2 in face studies. And so we can summarize the crop yield responses shown here. So maize and sorghum, the C4 crops that have been grown in face studies show no significant change in yield at elevated CO2. Rice shows a 12% increase on average, wheat a 13% increase, and soybean about a 14% increase at elevated CO2. And so these are really rather modest responses to elevated CO2 in terms of seed yield. And our prediction held true, so the mean response of crop photosynthesis, at least for C3 crops, was greater than the response of biomass, that's what's shown here, which in turn was greater than the response of seed yield. And so that hypothesis was held true in the FACE studies. And so one of the things that we also tried to do with this analysis was compare what the results from FACE with what has been previously determined from controlled environment studies. And so obviously one of the big advantages of controlled environment studies is that you can use a broad range of CO2 concentrations and therefore generate response curves. And so what this figure is showing you here is the yield at elevated CO2 or subambient CO2 relative to ambient CO2. And all of the points here show 100 part per million intervals, the average and 100 part per million intervals from controlled environment studies. And then we fit a non-rectangular hyperbolic response to those points. So here soybean is shown in blue and wheat is shown in red. The same was done for C4 crops, so maize and sorghum grown at elevated CO2 in chambers. And these were the response curves that were predicted from all of the studies that were done in the past. On top of this plot, then we put the results from the FACE studies. And so you can see that soybean and wheat showed, you know, the average responses that I showed you in the last graph of about 13 to 14% change. And then the C4 showed no significant difference in FACE studies. And if you compare 550 ppm, where the FACE studies were done, with the response curve, this is where we get the figure that the response in FACE is about half of what might be predicted from the chamber studies. And in the C4 crops, they predicted about a 15% increase, and really there was no increase. And so this comparison has been criticized for not accounting for differences in ambient CO2. And so when Ken talked this morning about the studies that were done in the spar chambers in Florida, they were done at 330 parts per million as their ambient CO2 concentration, whereas right now we're at 382. In the FACE studies, the range is probably from about 365 to 382 parts per million at ambient. And so what we did then was then subset that data. And so we limited the chamber data to ambient elevated CO2 concentrations that were in the same range as the FACE data and had the same mean ambient and elevated CO2 concentrations. And then we just did a t-test, and we did a non-parametric t-test based on 43 enclosure studies and 20 FACE studies, and again we found a significant difference. And the prediction was about a 29% increase for enclosure studies versus a 14% increase for FACE studies, and this is for C3 plants. And so we were convinced then that this data and this conclusion is real, and that in fact the yield response in FACE studies is less than the yield response predicted from chamber studies. And so I've gone on then to compare the rice yield responses, because again in the previous slide this was based on all C3 crops that were grown under FACE conditions. And so I went on then to compare just the response of rice to elevated CO2 under different experimental conditions. And here GH stands for greenhouse, SC is a sunlit chamber, for example the spar chambers that Ken talked about this morning, then OTC is the open top chambers that Rich just talked to us about, and then obviously the FACE. And so here the elevated CO2 concentrations are divided into 500 to 509 parts per million CO2 to 600 to 600 parts per million CO2. So again, trying to account for the fact that we're comparing relevant CO2 concentrations with each other. And what this plot generally shows is that the more natural the condition, or the more the experimental condition mimics field conditions, the smaller the response. And in fact, perhaps one of the mechanisms behind this is that light-saturated photosynthesis, which is shown in panel C here, is about double in controlled in growth chambers, sunlit chambers, and open-top chambers, what it was in FACE experiments. So, you know, it may actually be the stimulation in photosynthesis that's driving this stronger response, at least in the experiments with rice. And so there are quite a few limitations to FACE, before you clap. There have been few replicated large-scale FACE experiments with food crops, as I showed you in that map. And the interactions are virtually untested in FACE experiments. Also from the map, you could see that there were no tropical or cold temperate studies to date. There have been now two ozone phase experiments with crop, one on soybean in Urbana, Illinois, and a second on wheat in China. But there aren't enough data from these two experiments yet to do a meta-analysis. And so what we've done instead is do a meta-analysis on the chamber studies that have been done. And this just shows the effects of elevated ozone concentrations on rice. And basically what you can see is that everything from carbon uptake to growth and biomass to final yields are reduced by ozone concentrations. And these are the ozone concentrations that were on average used for each of these mean values. You can also see that the decrease in yield is largely from a decrease in grain number, but also from some decrease in grain weight. And this provides an interesting comparison. So elevated ozone reduces rice carbon uptake, leaf area index, total above ground biomass, and yield. And that the yield reductions are driven by changes in grain number and also grain weight. We also did a similar study with soybean, and this was work led by Pat Morgan. And essentially what this shows is that the more you increase ozone concentration, the greater decrease in seed yield that you see. And so soybean seed yield is reduced by elevated CO2 concentrations, and at modest concentrations, the yield reduction was driven by changes in seed weight, so that's what you see here. But at higher concentrations, it's also driven by changes in pod number. And so I just want to end by saying that elevated CO2 and elevated ozone, while they are important elements of climate change, they're perhaps not the most telling in terms of what future crop yields will be. And so these are just a few figures from the IPCC showing the expected increases in temperature and also the changes in precipitation and the changes in the number of dry days. And these are things that we cannot easily simulate with phase experiments. So with that, I'd like to again acknowledge my co-authors on this work, and especially June Che and Mariela Rivera, who have helped with the rice meta-analysis. Thank you.
We have 3 minutes for questions, so before the break.
Yep.
Go ahead.
You might add potatoes to your analysis.
Sure. Yeah, so I didn't add the potato face experiment. Most of this was based on the major food crops and grain crops, but the face experiments with potato were smaller in scale, and so some of the things like the effects of having so some of the advantages of face are that you have a closed canopy. You can actually kind of see that in this picture here, and so with a smaller face experiments, you don't actually have that advantage always, and so, but yeah, that's true. I could add that.
I would, having listened to Steve talk about this last year and now your excellent summary now, I would submit that there's so many interactions with CO2, water potential, business coatings, or closing, that you could look at the controlled environment studies and see some that are obviously not relevant to the field, like the plants have more ample water in the field, side lighting effects.
Sure.
Throw those out of the study because you can see some obvious problems. And then the controlled environment studies with increasing levels of control would match the phase studies a lot better.
And perhaps that's true. I don't know that there is a good unbiased way to do that, though. So one of the advantages, or one of the assumptions of a meta-analysis, is that you use all of the data that are available.
Do you include the bad data?
Well, you include all of the published studies, and so, you know, I mean, who's to say if it's peer-reviewed and it's in the literature? I mean, there are clearly things that get through that shouldn't, but you know, if a study looks at the question that you're addressing using the parameters that you've set up to address, then how can you throw away some data and keep other data? It is a difficult question, I think, with this sort of a statistical.
Sunlight is insignificant. Some controlled environment
Right.
And that's a yes or no question, looking at the literature.
Sure. I would say that, you know, going through all of these studies, what is and is not controlled is not always explicitly stated in the paper. So, I mean, that's also a problem. But certainly, and I think that one of the advantages of a meta-analysis is that you can have a category for sidelighting. You know, do they block that? You know, is it not? And does it statistically make a difference on your response? And so that's one of the advantages of this approach. Yep.
As one with no stake in this debate, possibly the politically correct conclusion to draw here with respect to space as opposed to the environment study is that they're both wrong. Because neither, as Bruce was indicating, neither take into account the other five major environmental variables that interact and the host of minor environmental variables in soil and elsewhere. So it's really difficult, I think, to draw the kinds of general conclusions that we're attempting to here on global climate change on the basis of this kind of narrow focus.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, although, I mean, when we wrote the science paper, one of the points we wanted to make was that something has to feed the model. Some data have to inform the models. And Rich made this point earlier, that the models are only as good as the information that goes into it. And so when we were looking back, you know, through what information goes into the models, it was reviews from the 1980s. And research has come a long way since then, and there are a lot of more recent reviews, and there are a lot of different sorts of experiments that have, you know, that could potentially be used. And so, you know, we might not be at the right answer yet. And like I just said, you know, CO2 is only one aspect of climate change, and perhaps not the most important. But it is one, you know, and so we need to use something.